This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham, and we've got a lot for you today. First, a candidate for governor spouts off about race and religion, and surprise, there's some backlash.
Put them all in a category of stupid.
We'll talk to the leader of a group working to stop the legalization of marijuana.
Just because other states have done it doesn't make it right, and it doesn't make it right for Michigan.
Big electric utilities want to stop federal policy requiring them to buy renewable energy.
It's a way of providing clean energy at no additional cost to Michigan customers.
Plus, there's a book of stories from the Rust Belt, including a few from Michigan.
She talks about the kidnapped children of Detroit because it was like one morning, all of her white friends were gone and nobody would tell her where they went.
Then an audio postcard from the Repair Cafe.
Repair them and fix them and just to value our things instead of just being such a disposable society.
And we have a new artisan of Michigan. All of that and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Michigan Elections Board has agreed there are enough petition signatures to put a proposal to legalize recreational use of marijuana on the ballot in November. Now, the state legislature can approve that initiative if it wants to right now. If it doesn't do that within 40 days, then the proposal will be on the ballot. Maybe. The group Healthy and Productive Michigan opposes legalizing recreational marijuana. It might file a court challenge. Scott Greenlee heads up that group, and he joins us now. A story I heard from Rick Pluta indicates you may file a challenge. Are you going to do that?
Well, first of all, thanks very much for having us on the air. We're considering all our options. We believe that the legalization of recreational marijuana in Michigan would be a huge mistake for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is it would put us in conflict with U.S. law and the Controlled Substance Act.
Well, that's not stopped eight other states from legalizing recreational use of marijuana. And, of course, 30 states, including Michigan, have legalized some form of medical marijuana. Pardon the pun, but it kind of seems like a grassroots movement. How are you going to stop that?
Well, you know, my mom taught me when I was old enough to understand what she was saying, that if one of my friends jumped off a bridge, I didn't have to join them. I could do the right thing. And in America, we have a system set up where Michigan essentially conforms to the laws and the rules of the United States, just as individual counties and municipalities in Michigan conform to state law. So we have a real problem with this from the fact that it is a violation of federal law. And just because other states have done it doesn't make it right, and it doesn't make it right for Michigan.
You know, when the majority of the people in the state, at least according to a recent Epic MRI survey, think that marijuana should be legalized, why should voters in the state be denied the opportunity to vote on it just because your group doesn't like it and might challenge it in court?
I mean, that's a very reasonable question. Polling in this day and age, as we saw from the last presidential election, isn't always necessarily spot on. And I think that a lot of the polling that's been done have been very quick one and two type question polls versus doing a deep dive and doing education of the challenges.
I mean, I've dealt with Epic MRA. In fact, I've hired Epic MRA, and I trust their work. So let's not diss the pollsters. Let's get to the question.
Oh, I'm not dissing the pollsters at all. They're a very reputable firm. But I think you saw in the last election that all firms, every single one of them, was off. And in this day and age, without any voter education, without pointing out that so many people in Michigan and so many organizations like the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, most of your law enforcement organizations, most of your medically based organizations are against this, it's much easier to have a sure, sounds fine, marijuana didn't harm me when I tried it 20 years ago or whatever people say. It's not your father's marijuana. It's much stronger. And there are a lot of people in Michigan that are against this, even more when they get some education.
There are also a lot of people in Michigan who smoke marijuana now and at some risk to their, they might become incarcerated. If it's already happening to a great degree and the majority of the people, according to this poll, think that it should be legalized, why shouldn't we allow those people to make that choice in their life?
I definitely enjoy discussing the incarceration end of this because I think that there's a narrative out there that either marijuana has to be completely legal or people are winding up in jail, and that's just not the case. Most of the people that go to jail or prison are because of marijuana being involved somehow with their charges, are folks that are on probation violations, folks that have the intent to distribute and sell. The average person who goes out and smokes a joint or has a brownie or a gummy or what have you is either going to get a warning or they're going to get a fine. It's like a ticket situation, like somebody's speeding. Now, if you're habitual, if you're on probation for assault and battery, if you've gotten DUIs, that's a whole different story. But at that point, the punishment isn't about the marijuana. The punishment is about the other crimes that have been committed.
Well, the Republicans and Democrats alike have said they want to see the Department of Corrections incarceration rate for people in there for nonviolent drug offenses reduced. So how does your opposition to this initiative affect that bipartisan effort to reduce the cost for corrections?
Yeah, again, we're not opposed to anything from a penalty standpoint that they're looking at. We just don't think that it should be widespread legal and utilized recreationally in Michigan. And again, I'll push back on some of those stories that are out there. The vast majority of people that are in prison for marijuana use are on either a probation violation or had some other crime involved and they're being written up. If folks are out on the street smoking a joint, they're not getting grabbed off the street, locked up, handcuffed, and thrown in jail. It's just not happening.
If your court's challenge, if you file it, does not stop the initiative from reaching the ballot, what would be your next move?
So we will be working with a lot of corporate partners and individual partners in Michigan to raise money to educate the public. We believe that when the public understands that things haven't exactly gone great in states like Colorado, Washington, California, and that states like Ohio, Vermont, and Arizona, the good people there have voted this initiative down and both said no to recreational marijuana, that Michiganders will feel the same way. They'll see the risks. They'll see that the tax dollars aren't always as what they're projected or planned. They'll understand a lot about some of the unintended consequences, and they'll do the right thing and uphold the federal law and vote no.
What corporations, what groups would fund that effort?
You know, there's a lot of them. The Michigan Chamber has come out, and most chambers are very strongly against this because of the detrimental nature of recreational marijuana on industry and on the job market in any state. And I think at the appropriate time, we will bring forward a lot of corporate partners that look at this as just a disaster for business and for the economy in Michigan. And I'd again refer you to the Michigan Chamber. The Grand Rapids Chamber is already out publicly. And much more to come on the business front, I assure you of that.
Scott Greenlee is with Healthy and Productive Michigan, a group which opposes legalizing marijuana in the state. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Maybe you've heard of cat cafes or board game cafes, tech cafes. Well, what about repair cafes? Last week, the White Lake Township Library, about 35 miles northwest of Detroit, held its fourth repair cafe. Instead of throwing away a broken lamp or a shirt with a hole in it, people came to the library to get them fixed. Experts from the community set up tables like flea markets and volunteered their services. Organizers say last year, the library held the first repair cafe in Michigan. Now, at least five other communities have joined in. Stateside's Danny Hensel went to White Lake to check out the latest repair cafe and brought us this audio postcard.
Hi, my name is Denise Harris Feams, and I am the programming librarian at the White Lake Township Library. And about a year and a half ago, I saw an article in Library Journal about Repair Cafe. I thought, well, we could do that here. So I started finding people who could fix things and said, this is the date. And we thought it would be in conjunction with Money Smart Week, to a way to save money by fixing your things instead of throwing them away and replacing them. And then also as part of Earth Day, instead of, again, putting things in landfills, we would repair them and fix them and just to value our things instead of just being such a disposable society. This is the one room we have, and we have tables set around the room with different people who can help fix things. It's been a good experience. People are happy. There's networking going on, and it's a nice vibe in the room.
Hi, I'm Diane Kroll. I'm from Clarkston, Michigan. I always like to put the needle down first because it holds my fabric in place, one of my little tricks. I teach sewing lessons, and I like to give easy tips. I have brought one of my assorted sewing machines, and I'm doing repairs for people. This morning, I shortened straps on an outfit for a little girl for her recital. She was so cute. And checked on a couple zipper repairs, put in a hem in a pair of pants. I think that there are so many people who have no clue that what they have can be fixed. You know, we're kind of a throwaway society, that it's broken, there's no hope, let me just get a new one. And so many times it's a minor repair that will make something functional again.
Hi, I'm Nancy Fout. I'm from Waterford. Knives and clippers. They were dull. And one of the clippers, you said, needs to be some tight stuff put on it or some fingernail polish so the bolts will be tighter.
Well, this is knife sharpening. My name is Walker Sharp, and I'm from White Lake, just across the street. My dad taught me how to do this. Probably started about 8 years old, and I'm 60 now. Yes, ma'am, I think that'll do it. We just took out some of the nicks right here, and I think those will be better than the other ones. But just use some Loctite on those.
My name is Melissa Schmantowski, and I live in White Lake, Michigan. I repair DVDs and CDs. Actually, I work at the library, so I've been here for about 11 years, and I just want to be a part of this event because it's so important. One of the people that usually is here and repairs jewelry, his son had a DVD or a CD that his grandmother had made for him, and it was scratched. And he's a child, and this was his grandmother. She passed away. We were able to fix that so that he could listen to his grandma again. And now we have that relationship with that jeweler. We have people come in that are looking for one thing and see another. There are neighbors that meet here. We just had two people come in who are new to the community who have skills that they can share with others. It's just a wonderful thing to see the community coming in, to see new friendships being made, people catching up with each other. It's just beautiful.
Coming up, designing steampunk jewelry.
Well, I use a lot of antique clockworks, meaning gears, and mostly brass and parts of pocket watches and wristwatches, anything I can find that's of a certain age.
And we check in with our Friday political commentators. That's at 20 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've been looking into changes to the Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act. It's called PURPA for short. That federal act requires electric utilities to buy energy from solar, wind, and other renewable generators as long as they didn't have to pay more than it cost the utility to generate that power itself. Michigan Congressman Tim Walberg wants to end PURPA. We recently talked to the congressman and a solar energy provider, but we felt like we needed to know a little bit more about PURPA. To help us with that, Marguerite Kearney joins us. She's senior staff attorney with the Grand Rapids Office of the Environmental Law and Policy Center. Hi there.
Hi, Lester. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the basics. PURPA was passed in 1978. What was its purpose?
Well, the purpose of PURPA when it was passed was really to reduce reliance on fossil fuels, and that was seen as a way to increase American energy independence, to diversify the resources that we use in this country to provide our energy.
So how has it affected the development of renewable energy in Michigan?
Well, in Michigan, PURPA is starting to have a really profound impact on developing renewable energy. And I should mention that really one of the stated goals of PURPA was to encourage the development of small renewable energy and cogeneration projects. In Michigan, the Michigan Public Service Commission recently revisited its methodology for determining avoided cost and updated those rates. As a result, we've seen a huge interest from solar developers in Michigan. And there are a lot of folks who are filing interconnection applications so that they can generate solar energy here in the state of Michigan.
Besides Congressman Wahlberg's proposal to end the Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act, one of Michigan's big electric utilities, Consumers Energy, has asked the Michigan Public Service Commission, the state's utility regulator, for exemptions from the requirement to purchase renewable energy. What's Consumers' stated reasoning for that?
Well, Consumers has come to the commission claiming that they have no capacity need and that therefore the commission's rate shouldn't apply to them. A different rate should apply. This is kind of an interesting development since during the course of over 2 years in these cases, Consumers clearly stated that it had up to a 700 megawatt capacity need. So it's a little bit surprising that suddenly when these avoided costs are set, Consumers is claiming no need for capacity.
A little incongruent there. Are other big utilities like DTE also trying to extract themselves from PURPA requirements to buy renewable energy?
Yeah, they absolutely are. So with DTE, what's really the big concern is the company is asking to recover $1 billion from customers to build an 1,100 megawatt natural gas plant on the east side of the state. And in all of its modeling, even though DTE recognized that under these new avoided cost rates, there was significant interest in solar development and that they expected there to be a lot more solar development, they didn't model any additional solar when they were looking at the resources that would be available to meet their capacity need. And they've actually been telling interested developers that they have no capacity need. Of course, at the same time, they're telling developers they have no need for capacity. They're turning to the commission and telling the commission that they have a substantial capacity need that they need to meet with a $1 billion natural gas plant.
How would an exemption or the end of PURPA affect renewable energy providers in Michigan?
I think it would have a really profound impact on what is shaping up to be a very healthy market. In that space, you know, Consumers raises a lot of issues with the commission and seems very concerned about the number of developers who have filed applications to do solar projects. I think that number is great. It's really promising. It's something that everyone in Michigan should be really excited about because it means more clean, renewable energy at no additional cost. If the commission grants this exemption or prevents PURPA from moving forward, I think it's going to have a really negative impact on that really positive growth.
So future development is at risk.
Absolutely.
Congressman Wahlberg has said that PURPA has been effective. It did exactly what it was supposed to do, encourage the development of renewable energy. But he says this law is no longer needed. What do you think of that argument?
It's still needed. The goals of PURPA to encourage development of small renewable energy, to provide a mechanism really for competition in what is a regulated market, those needs are still there. Those goals are still very important. We are in a state where the utilities have a monopoly on energy production. What PURPA does is it provides a piece of competition in that monopolistic market, and it allows these small power producers to come in and to provide clean energy to customers at no additional cost. When I look around Michigan, I see a lot of folks who care a lot about their environment, about the air that they breathe, about the legacy that they're leaving to their children. So I think that PURPA absolutely still has an important role to play in policy.
What's the bottom line here? Why do Michigan big utility companies want to end the requirement of buying energy from these smaller renewable energy providers? Is it a matter of cost or just a matter of they don't want that competition when they're thinking about going into solar and wind themselves? What is it?
Yeah, that's right, Lester. The way that they make their money, utilities build big generating units, and then they recover the cost of those units plus a rate of return on the cost of building those units. So the way utilities really make money is by building stuff themselves. PURPA is something that says, hey, if someone else can build it at a lower cost, or can build it and you pay them the same amount that it would have cost you to build it, then let's go ahead and let those other folks build it. Let's create some competition. And that, of course, reduces the amount of money that the utility makes.
I don't think the utilities would ever concede that.
My guess is that they would give a number of reasons why they have concerns about PURPA. But when you go through those reasons categorically, it's clear that none of them apply. And that at the end of the day, what PURPA is it's a way of providing clean energy at no additional cost to Michigan customers. And that's something that, you know, regardless of the obstacles that are put in front of it, is really important and the people of Michigan need to fight for and support.
Marguerite Kearney is Senior Staff Attorney with the Grand Rapids Office of the Environmental Law and Policy Center. Thanks very much for explaining PURPA to us.
Thanks for having me.
In the interest of full disclosure, Consumers Energy is a sponsor of Michigan Radio. There's a new collection of stories from Michigan and other Midwest states called Voices from the Rust Belt. 24 writers deal with diverse topics ranging from witnessing segregation, exploring childhood events that leave their mark on adulthood, and some quirks of history about where we live. Joining me now is the editor of this collection, Anne Trebek. How did you go about selecting these stories for inclusion in Voices from the Rust Belt?
These essays, many of them had been published in different forms on either Belt Magazine or Belt Publishing, which are two outlets that I run here in Cleveland dedicated to writing about the Rust Belt overall. And I wanted to select essays from this pool of writing that I'd been publishing for a few years that would best sort of give those who may be less familiar with the region a sense of the diversity and variety of people and voices and issues here, as well, of course, as giving people from the region that sense of what we have going for us, what we're struggling against, and the amazing writers in this region.
Well, I want to concentrate on the Michigan stories included in Voices from the Rust Belt. One of the stories is from Marsha Music. The story is The Kidnapped Children of Detroit. It captures a young black girl's perspectives as she watches nearly all of the white families in her Detroit neighborhood move away. What was it about that particular story that prompted you to include it in this collection?
That piece, first of all, it's so beautifully written. But, you know, I'm someone who knows about white flight and redlining and blockbusting and these issues, and I read about it. But that essay is when the first time I really understood it, particularly how fast things happen. She talks about the kidnapped children of Detroit because it was like one morning all of her white friends were gone and nobody would tell her where they went. And it was like they had been kidnapped. And it was that sort of rapidity of how this huge historic change happened that I think is just so amazingly rendered in that essay.
Yeah, that personal story really brought out the humanness of this historic event we know happened, but it really puts it in a perspective that I don't think a lot of people have realized, or at least a lot of white people haven't realized. The next story I want to talk about is Love and Survival, a Flint Romance by Layla Millier. It starts out with the love of a young girl and her first bike, but what does that story tell us about life?
She is really talking about how, you know, her bikes get stolen when she was a young girl. Although I should mention here that Layla was 17 when she wrote this essay. It's amazingly proficient for a 17-year-old. And, you know, she's writing about how when she was 10, her bike was stolen and it gets recovered. She lives in Flint. And the piece is really about loving something that hurts you, but still loving it. And being able to be vulnerable to that loss, whether it's your bike or so much of Flint, it's so subtle and powerful. I can't read it without choking up at the end.
Yeah, there's a really interesting twist to that story, and it says a lot about what an event in someone's life can do to them. Let's move on to the city of Detroit's official storyteller, Aaron Foley. He's included in this collection. And his story is, Can Detroit Save White People? It's more of an essay than a story, and it questions the idea that young white people are moving to Detroit to find themselves or save themselves. What did you think of Foley's essay?
Oh, I mean, Aaron is, you know, he is just out there speaking his truth, and he's so powerful and so empathetic and compassionate in his strong views about the problems with this idea that Detroit is a sort of blank slate to be discovered, or, you know, that we can have a sort of imperialist project where we go to, you know, a native land and improve it for the natives there. And Aaron is like, we've been here. We know this city. We are this city. And maybe it's you guys coming who need the help, not us.
One of my favorites in Voices from the Rust Belt comes from James D. Grafune. It's called The Photopias of Detroit's Suburbs. Tell us what that story's about.
That's a story that's really looking at sort of these larger trends about suburbanization. He's talking a lot about Greenfield Village and the influence of Henry Ford, and really looking at changes in the city, cities in general, but also Detroit in particular over the last 50, 60 years, which is, you know, such an important story to understanding this region, how the cities have changed, how the importance of the suburbs are really crucial to all sorts of larger currents that we're dealing with and thinking about on a daily basis.
And had some ironic twists about Henry Ford, who is, you know, such a controversial subject in many ways. I thought it was a really, really very interesting story. The most heartbreaking story, though, is another one from Flint. This is one about a parent, his young child, and bath time. What struck you about that story?
Oh, I don't think anybody who has read that story isn't struck by it. Here you have someone who's writing right after the beginning of the Flint water crisis. He's someone who grew up in Flint, left, was educated, you know, went away for college, worked, and decided he wanted to move back to Flint and make a life there because it was important to him to do that, to, you know, for his hometown, dragged his wife back, convinced her it was going to be great. And then shortly after they arrive, the water crisis hits and they've got a toddler. And they need to give the toddler a bath. And toddlers like to drink the bath water. And so he talks about all these decisions that he's made about Flint and the promises that he made his wife about Flint and what's happening to him as he's trying to keep his daughter from drinking the water.
He was so self-assured about his knowledge of his hometown and knew he could handle anything it threw at him and then the Flint water crisis. That was not what he was expecting.
Not part of the deal that he thought he was signing up for.
I should mention that these stories are Michigan stories, but there are stories from the surrounding states. Did you have another favorite of yours, maybe from Ohio or Indiana or some other place?
There is a really gorgeous essay from Pittsburgh called Rust Belt Heroin Chic. And this is a story of a single father who's raising his daughter with her mother, who is addicted to heroin. He's just an extraordinary writer. So it's sort of like Kidnapped Children of Detroit, in which you can understand something, the opiate crisis going on right now, in such a visceral, emotional, and personal way through that essay. And it's just extraordinary. The author is Ben Gwynn. He has a novel coming out soon. He's just a fantastic writer.
Well, the book is Voices from the Rust Belt. It includes a lot of these urban stories that we've been talking about, but also some rural stories as well. It's edited by Anne Trebek. Thanks very much for telling us about these stories.
Thanks so much for inviting me to talk about them.
Anne Trebek will be speaking at Literati Bookstore in Ann Arbor Wednesday evening, May 2nd. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I like hanging out with people who make things by hand, and then I report back to you. And we call the series Artisans of Michigan. We're in Flint at Scared Crow Steamworks. Heather Wright is the designer of steampunk jewelry, which leads us to the first question I asked.
What do you mean by steampunk?
Steampunk is a movement that was started back in the 80s. It has to do with sort of post-apocalyptic lifestyle, if technology never really evolved and steam-driven things were still here today.
How does that translate to your jewelry?
Well, I use a lot of antique clockworks, meaning gears, and mostly brass and parts of pocket watches and wristwatches, anything I can find that's of a certain age. It has to be early 1900s and earlier than that.
I have seen on Amazon bags full of steampunk type pieces that were stamped out in a plant in China. Why do you go to the trouble of finding these older pieces when you could, you know, do it for a lot less and probably most people wouldn't even know the difference?
I really want people to have a connection to the history of it, and I think that it's more unique because they're more difficult to find many of, especially some of the pocket watches. They have dates on them from the people who repair them, and I think that's a real connection to history, and I like that part of it.
Her work area is basically an L-shaped bench, and on one section, there's just this pile of gears and coils and pocket watch faces. I'm not sure how Wright makes sense out of this tangle of 100-year-old pieces and sees jewelry there.
Well, I don't really like to clean up too much. I'm just kind of a mess here because it helps me think about what I want to make. I'll change my gears many, many times. I'll be working on 5 or 6 pieces at a time, and it just helps me to think a little bit more about what I want to do.
Is there anything unique about how you assemble these?
I like to refer to myself as kind of an architect. I sort of like to build the piece, and I never really glue until I feel like it's it looks finished, and then I'll take a photograph of it with my phone, and I'll later assemble it with the glue, and sometimes it'll change, sometimes it'll stay the same.
Who buys your jewelry?
Oh, many people. I'm surprised sometimes at who's interested in what I have. Some people have no idea what steampunk is. People of all ages, small kids, older adults, but everybody's really interested in men and women alike.
How many pieces have you made?
Oh, gosh, probably over 1,000, maybe. I've been doing this for, I think, about since 2014. So I've sold quite a bit and made quite a bit, and I hope to make more.
That's Heather Wright. She's the designer at Scared Crow Steamworks, and she's our latest Artisan of Michigan. By the way, you can see photos of her work on our website, michiganradio.org. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. We'll be right back after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Local mental health agencies around the state say the Department of Health and Human Services refuses to acknowledge a funding shortage that's leaving some of those agencies in serious deficit. Tens of thousands of people eligible for disabled, aged, and blind Medicaid assistance have been transferred to the Healthy Michigan Plan. According to the Community Mental Health Association of Michigan, the problem with that is this. The base rate amount paid to agencies to serve those people through Medicaid is $267. Under Healthy Michigan, it's $29 plus another $15 under temporary assistance for needy families. That's $267 versus $44. The local agencies are expected to offer the same services to the disabled, aged, and blind and dip into their own reserves to make up the difference. Statewide, the association says that's a net loss of revenue of more than $97 million. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services says this is just part of the ebb and flow of funding, and it should be expected. Linda Zeller is deputy director over behavioral health and developmental behavioral health and developmental disabilities.
What our actuaries have told us is that this issue they've raised, this DAB to Healthy Michigan or DAB to TANF, is still within normal fluctuation and does not require additional revenue.
The state does not acknowledge that it failed to foresee that this shift of clients from Medicaid to Healthy Michigan would cause this revenue shortage for mental health agencies in the state. To learn more about that, let's turn to Representative Ed Canfield. He's a physician and he chairs the Appropriations Subcommittee on Health and Human Services. Welcome.
Thank you, Les.
Is the normal ebb and flow of revenue, as the Department of Health and Human Services says, is that what's happening here, or is this an unforeseen shortcoming of the Healthy Michigan plan?
I think it's a bit of both. That's what we're really trying to sort out at this point.
So people eligible for DAB, that's DAB for Disabled, Aged, and Blind, have been shifted to the Healthy Michigan plan in large numbers recently. Fiscal year 2016, there were 27,000. 2017, there's nearly 42,000. Do you know any reason that the Department of Health and Human Services has been shifting clients from DAB and Medicaid to Healthy Michigan?
Well, I mean, I don't believe that the Department of Health and Human Services is actively shifting people. Now, one thing that may have been discussed is that to be in DAB, you have to go through a process which indicates that you are qualified for disabled, aged, and blind. That is a process that we've determined can take up to 100 days. It's a lengthy process. You have to go to providers. You have to have sign-off. And the opposite side of that, and this is the perceived thought, is that they're given a choice. You can go into DAB. You can be in DAB, but you got to jump through these hoops. Or you can go into Healthy Michigan, and you don't have to. All you have to do is sign up because you meet income qualifications. And that's really easy for clients. However, for the community mental health organizations, they miss out on that appropriate funding. I think what Linda Zeller is indicating is that when this all gets sorted out, if these people truly do belong in DAB or they do deserve a higher level of care, that will get sorted out. And in the contracts that they've written, I think this is an unintended consequence that you've got to wait a couple of years before we really determine that that happens.
Now, have some of these clients that that are being transferred to are entering the Healthy Michigan plan, were some of them already eligible and in DAB for Medicaid?
I believe that is the case, and that's one of the things that we're concerned about, because the Healthy Michigan program was designed for the working poor that were not otherwise covered by a Medicaid product. And we feel that there may be some people moving over that actually do qualify and are in a Medicaid product. Now, one of the things we have to be careful about is people may get into DAB when they're being evaluated for disability. Once that evaluation comes from the federal government and it says, no, you do not qualify, you will be moved off of DAB. Consequently, you will qualify for being in Healthy Michigan, and that's part of that migration as well. But I believe there is some problem with what's going on. There certainly is some shift in numbers of people in the different programs, and we really need to get to the bottom of it.
The Community Mental Health Association of Michigan indicates that mental health service funding is really more adversely impacted because 64% of all mental health Medicaid funding is derived from the disabled, aged, and blind population counts, the DAB counts. Was the state agency somehow unaware of the funding shortage that might be caused by transferring DAB clients to Healthy Michigan?
Again, I think this is an unintended consequence if it is occurring. So two things are going on, and I think this is important to understand. Number one, a diminution or a decrease in the number of people that are in or needing the service, and there is some question as to whether some of these clients also are migrating inappropriately from DAB to Healthy Michigan or TANF.
How concerned are you about this? Are you looking into it? Are you trying to find out exactly what's happening here before you have some offer some kind of corrective action?
Oh, we're absolutely looking at it. Several representatives are on the forefront. The leaders are aware of this problem. We've had meetings not only with the department, including Linda Zeller and her crew, but also with community mental health organizations. We have gotten them together to try to better understand this problem, and I think we do have a clear picture of what's going on, and we have asked the important questions that we need to ask to get down to the bottom of the problem, which I will say may take several months to figure out. But we do believe that there's a problem, and we are serious about getting to the bottom of it.
In the meantime, as one agency head told me, these clients are no less disabled, no less aged, no less blind, yet the local agencies are getting much less money and expected to offer the same level of services. So what's the solution in the interim?
Well, we will have to reimburse, I'm assuming, if that is determined to be a problem. I'm saying we, the department, the state of Michigan, and taxpayers will have to make up that difference. And that's an appropriate adjustment if that's the case. The question is it the case we need to get? What we did is we got both parties' numbers folks together to try to iron this out. I think it helped us clarify the problem. We're going to continue to work on it.
That's Representative Ed Canfield. He chairs the House and Appropriations Subcommittee on Health and Human Services. He's also a physician. Thanks for talking with us about this.
Thank you, Les.
Okay, let's check in with our Friday commentators. We have Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate, and Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Patrick Colbeck is a Republican who's running for governor. He was videotaped saying a Democrat running for governor, Abdul El-Sayed, is part of a Muslim plot to take over the country, a civilization jihad intent on implementing Sharia law. He added El-Sayed's parents apparently have ties to the Muslim Brotherhood back in Egypt. None of this is supported by any facts. The video has been posted on a white supremacy website. Yesterday, State Senator Colbeck doubled down during a speech on the Senate floor, repeating some of these same allegations, and I understood he backed it up again on WJR. So, Ken, what do you make of this brand of political campaigning?
These comments from Senator Colbeck, I don't see how you could characterize him other than just being stupid and actually distasteful and potentially bigoted. And, you know, the more we talk about it, I don't know, it seems like the more we sink down into the level of those comments. But unfortunately, you know, these kind of comments, nastiness in campaigns occur. What's kind of unique about this is normally it's surrogates who make them rather than the candidates themselves. But when a candidate makes them like this, it does, I think, make you think twice about putting that person in any kind of position of public responsibility.
Well, he already is in a position of public responsibility. He's a state senator from Canton. But beyond that, Vicki, the state Republican Party has condemned Senator Colbeck's comments. But this kind of a behavior is popping up among office holders in different places in the state, not just the legislative office holders, but others. What's happening here?
I think it's part of the broader fear-mongering against immigrants. That we don't understand the immigrant population and therefore we want to wall them off or taint them somehow. And this, it doesn't matter whether it's coming from President Trump talking about Mexican immigrants or Haitian immigrants or Honduran immigrants, or whether we're talking about Senator Colbeck's idea of what's going on in the American Muslim community, which there's no basis in fact for. So unfortunately, there is a small base of the right-wing element in the Republican Party that this plays to, and that's where he's going to get his votes for the primary win that he hopes to have. I think it's laudable that the mainstream Republican Party has disavowed these comments and has condemned them. The Democrats have condemned them for a long time, and they really have no place in American discourse.
Now, we've experienced this in our history as a country several times. We've seen Poles, Italians, Irish, Dutch, Chinese, all condemned as being some kind of threat to the United States. But what I really want to know is, how does this kind of fear-mongering actually motivate people to vote?
Well, I don't think it does motivate people to vote. I mean, you know, as Vicki pointed out, there might be some small slice, in this case, of the Republican Party way to the right that, you know, applauds or welcomes this kind of comment because it feeds it into their own sort of ignorance about it. But I don't see how this motivates people to vote. Maybe it motivates people to vote against somebody who makes these kind of comments. But to me, it's they're just stupid and they're bigoted. So let's just say what they are, and then, you know, hopefully, like I said, you know, people see that and don't advance this person into, you know, a higher level of public responsibility and move on.
Vicki?
Well, we've seen this throughout the history of political campaigns. You don't have to go too far back to remember when John F. Kennedy was running for president against Nixon in 1960. There was this element of the Republican Party and some Democrats, I would assume. I don't know. I was very young. I was a child of five. But during that campaign, there was this whole talk of Kennedy is a Catholic and is the Pope going to be running the country? And so that was used against Kennedy. The famous nuclear war with the little child holding the flower and then the mushroom cloud behind her was used in the Johnson versus Goldwater campaign, hinting that Goldwater would get us into nuclear war. The term fascism and white supremacist rights and those terms are coming up right now in political discourse, I don't think that motivates people to vote. I think, I agree with Ken, these kinds of comments have been used in politics for a long time. They will continue to be used by some elements, but people really want to vote for candidates that are going to do something positive for the country.
Well, I want to talk about another trend here, because as you mentioned, we are seeing these labels, these name-calling ideas flashed around a lot, especially in these days of social media. There's been this increasingly disturbing trend among Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives. Godwin's Law, that cites, if any online discussion goes on long enough, sooner or later someone will compare someone to or something to Nazis, Adolf Hitler, or his deeds. These days, that moment is happening a lot earlier. And, you know, it's like the fifth comment down. Why is this happening?
We've had these kinds of things throughout American history, as both you and Vicki have pointed out. Now, there is something going on today that contributes to this, and that is the polarization of the two parties. I think that allows, in this case, a Republican candidate to sort of appeal to the, you know, the arch right, if you will, and there might be something similar on the Democratic side. I don't know, but the polarization of the two parties sort of contributes to this in a primary situation. I just don't think the country is as polarized as the two parties are right now.
I agree with Ken. I think that there's a rising centrist movement. I remember when the worst thing you could be called was a Democrat or a liberal, and that, thank God, is beginning to fade. But there is a great polarization, and it's been enhanced by gerrymandering, quite frankly. When you have one party controlling, drawing the lines for all of the legislative districts in states, you end up with districts that are geared toward one party over another, and so the most extreme of that party will end up being facing off the most extreme of the other party, and that leads to this bifurcation. I think people right now are tired of it. They're tired of nothing getting done. They're tired of the roads crumbling. They're tired of water problems and infrastructure problems. They're tired of war on education. They want to see something done that's positive, that moves our state forward or our country forward, and we're beginning to see the backlash in voters coming out and saying enough is enough. It's time to work for the people of Michigan and the people of the United States.
Lester, you know what my biggest fear is? My biggest fear is sometime in the next few weeks, someone else is going to make a really stupid comment, and you're going to want Vicki and I to compare the comments to discuss which comment was stupidest, most distasteful, or most bigoted. And I don't want to have that conversation. Put them all in a category of stupid.
This is something I think was important to address, simply because just letting it stand and not looking at it, ignoring it, I think is almost as bad as giving it more press. But that's my opinion.
Well, hate crimes are on the rise in the country, and that's very clear. We're seeing that through the Anti-Defamation League in Jewish circles. And so there is a concern that these attacks will have real-world ramifications on real people. And we have to start talking about it as a nation and get past it so that we can do the things that we need to do.
That's Vicki Barnett. She's a former Democratic legislator, and we've been talking to Ken Sikkema. He's a former Republican legislator. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Hey, we're hoping you'll join us when Stateside goes on the road for a live show from Grand Rapids. We'll be at the Celebration Cinema North on Thursday evening, May 3rd, and we'd love to have you as part of the audience. You can register to attend and find out more on the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was engineered by Bob Skahn. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors include Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Joy Horan, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, and Danny Hansel. This is his last day with us. We want to wish him the best of luck as he heads to NPR. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.